Bloom, let's talk a little bit about the fun and the recreation you might have had during your adolescent years.
Yes, for a good while we couldn't afford to join the YMHA, remember it was called the YMHA in those days, and I envy those kids who do. I did was able to scrape a little bit together. And we did join the Y. I think it was $3 a year in those days. And I did learn to swim at the Y. And it was the greatest recreation in my life. And Lou Leon was then the athletic director. And he took a shine to me. And even though I wasn't long and lean built for swimming, he did work with me. And I became a very interested swimmer, a very active swimmer, member of the swim team. And a member of the William B. Clee Club basketball team. William B. Clee was then a prominent Pittsburgher, and it was I who went down to him in one of his spacious office to me in those days, and asked him if he would be our sponsor, and if he would like to buy us uniforms. That was during the Depression day, post-Depression. We were just coming out of the Depression, he exceeded, and I did a lot of basketball playing at the Y, and but particularly swimming. And it was impressed upon me by a teacher at Shenley that swimming is one exercise that is most nearly perfect in its form, because you can do it as long as you live. You don't have to pick a team or buy expensive equipment and clothes. In fact, the less clothes, the better when you swim. I swim to this day, a lot of swimming, and it's one exercise that tells you when you're tired. As I say, you don't have to belong to a team or buy expensive uniforms. You just go. I did a lot of hiking. Pittsburgh is blessed with wonderful parks, as you know. And I used to know all the trails of Shenley Park and all the trails of Frick Park, which helped me later, because when I wrote a story when I was at the Post Gazette about copperheads in Frick Park, all the naturalists disbelieved me. But we found them, and we put them on display for the naturalists to see. There were copperheads in Frick Park. There might be still some. I don't know. Don't let that make you afraid. I don't know anybody who's really been good about it. But I did a lot of hiking, a lot of kids' games, 1-2-3 release and that kind of thing, racing all over the town, Oakland and Squirrel Hill became quite well known. All the back alleys and were quite well known. We did a lot of walking and hiking since. Cars were a little beyond our reach at that time. I don't want to talk as though they were the antediluvian or Pleistocene days, but nevertheless, towards the ends of the Depression, young kids did have a hard time to go. And I might say that it was difficult all the way around. For instance, when I was in high school, I went down on Fifth Avenue looking for a job. And there were no jobs available. And I must say, I say it with respect and understanding. Nevertheless, when I thought maybe I would get a better reception in the Jewish stores along the Avenue. As you know, the Avenue was very active, 100 times more active than it is now, Upper Fifth Avenue uptown. And it's amusing to realize many of the Jewish-owned stores to which I went said no, they didn't have any job. Besides, if they did have one, they wouldn't hire a Jewish boy, because it would cause anti-Semitic propaganda, perhaps. Therefore, you were faced, as I was faced, with the fact that many doors were closed that were non-Jewish, and many doors were closed that were Jewish. So a little boy who would like to make 25 or 30 cents an hour had two sets of doors closed to him. In my heart's heart, it was a rather bitter pill to swallow, if you don't mind the mixed metaphor. I'm sure O. Henry wouldn't mind. But,
I don't mind. I think it's a, that's interesting and very amazing, I think.
Sure is.
Tell me, as when we're talking about recreation, was the Irene Kaufman Center not a factor? Well,
the Irene Kaufman Center was a factor, and a big factor, but not for me. I lived far away.
Because of the location.
Oakland. Yeah, I lived
see.
In Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it was something wonderful, but beyond my reach, even though it did educate many people on the Hill District. I was just a baby when we moved from Webster Avenue to Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
So it was literally and figuratively beyond my reach. The only I did swim against the swim team, the IKS,
mm-hmm.
and they were much better swimmers than we were. They had a wonderful athletic program.
And now that
later,
so
I
that you were
some
July.
Of those people became my great friends in later years.
One of them was Kaufman.
Oh, sure.
Right. Kaufman. What was his first name? He taught me this one. Still around.
It escapes me.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
He became a good friend of mine later.
Yeah.
Let's turn now to your courtship and marriage. Tell us about your wife, Evelyn, and how you met, and something about that.
My beautiful wife, Evelyn. Well, in due course, I became the youngest counselor at the day camp at the YMHA. Evelyn was one of the older campers. It was the first time that I met her.
What year did you meet her?
I'd say that was in about 1939-40, I guess it was. And she had bobbed hair in those days. Later, she had longer hair. That was a high school or college picture up there. You won't believe it, but she was a strawberry blonde. And her nickname was Redditch at Chatham College. At any rate...
Now, you were a counselor at the Y?
Yeah, I was one of the oldest counselors. And she was one of... as you were. I was one of the youngest counselors, and she was one of the oldest campers.
Now, where was this?
At the YMHA, Oakland.
A day camp kind of thing?
Day camp, yeah. And I taught swimming and baseball and mush ball and so on and so forth.
So you met her while during the summertime at a camping.
Yeah, when she was a child, I still call her my child bride. We lost contact for a good many years, and all through college, I didn't see her.
And she was at this time a camper, so she was not in college yet.
No, we were just kids. I was.
1939.
I think I was getting. Maybe it was 1930. I'm sorry. It was probably closer to 1936, I'm sorry.
1936.
I was just getting out of high school. And she was in grade school. Yeah. I'm 5 years older than Evelyn.
Mm-hmm.
We lost contact. She was still a kid, you know, and I was not in a position for a variety of reasons, either age-wise or fiscal-wise, to dating.
Mm-hmm.
We traveled in different groups. She was with a younger group. 5 years makes a lot of difference,
mm-hmm.
in your teens. At any rate, we were separated we didn't know we were separated, but...
You went different ways for a certain period of time.
For a number of years, until for a good many years. She had then gone to Chatham. I had gone to Duquesne. I didn't know her. I think W&J was the college sponsored with Chatham those days. And I went away to school. And I had been away then for 12 years. And I never thought I was going to come back to Pittsburgh. Never at all. Pittsburgh was dirty and grimy. I just didn't. And I told you one semblance of my experience in job hunting in Pittsburgh. So I thought I'd never want to come back here. However, but my family was here. And I went off to war, which I suppose...
Perhaps we ought to talk about this in a more chronological way.
You're asking about courtship.
I was asking about courtship, yes, but...
You want it?
Well, all right.
Up to you.
Yes, let's go back to the courtship. Fine. When did you come back to Pittsburgh then?
I came back to Pittsburgh in about 45, 46, after the... the EDI. I came back from China on 45 days R&R, rest and recuperation. I'd been in China for 2 years. And I came down came back around the holidays.
What holidays?
Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the Yom Merayim. And at that time, I had gone, previously when I was a kid, I had gone to Cheder Hebrew School at the Adas Yisrael on Dawson Street, across from the home school. That was a very Orthodox synagogue. And it's still in existence, by the way. They have a minyan every day. And it was a very nice, warm shul, very small. But that time when I got back, my father had started to go to the Tree of Life at that time. Evelyn's folks were one of the prominent members of the Tree of Life. I met her, I came back for Rosh Hashanah. And I saw her again. She was very bright and sprightly, and very lovely, as you can see. And she came up the aisle and our eyes met. She winked in shul. I saw her again on Yom Kippur. We dated. And 1 year later, even though I was out of the city in Washington, D.C., and at MacDill Air Force Base down in Florida, 1 year later, on the anniversary of that Yom Kippur, when we started to talk in the rain, out in Oakland, 1 year later, we got married.
When you saw her in shul, did you know and recall that you had met her before as a camper?
Of course. Oh, absolutely. I carried her in my head all over the world.
Yeah. What year was that?
Many vicissitudes.
That you were married. Can you remember?
When were you married?
The year that you were married?
She'll get mad at me if I don't know the exact date. 1946.
Do you know the date? We'll come back to that. All right, fine.
I don't remember the date.
Before we start talking any further about your married life, let's go back a little bit to when you graduated from Columbia University with your master's degree in journalism. What did you do at that point?
Well, I was going to go to work for El Mundo, which is the top paper in Puerto Rico, because I wanted to start to do some foreign traveling However, at Duquesne University, I was in the ROTC. That was a field artillery unit at Duquesne. And I became a reserve officer. This was now the time that, before the United States entered the war, that many of the reserve officers were called up to active duty. And I was called up to active duty under my reserve commission. And I was assigned to the office of the Chief of Staff in the War Department. It was called the War Department in those days. After the war, the forces were semi-merged into the Defense Department. But then it was the War Department.
When was this, do you recall?
1946. I'm sorry. As you were. That was in 1941, right. After I had been graduated from from Columbia, reserve officers, having been allowed to finish their year, whatever it is, and they were called up. Not everybody was called up before the war, but they're called up as needed. And I remember I had to get a physical at Carlisle. At that time, you had to pay your own way to get your physical to go into service. At any rate, I was called to duty under my reserve commission and assigned to the War Department in Washington, D.C. I was assigned to the Office of Chief of Staff. And because of my special training in the field, assigned to the War Department Bureau of Public Relations in the Office of the Chief of Staff. One of my main duties there was to help prepare for the Secretary of War's press conferences. Henry L. Stimson was Secretary of War, a very famous patriotic political leader. And I say prepare for his press conferences. We used to work with the members of the press in the press room to find out what kind of questions were going to be asked, because it helped the press and it helped the Secretary. Because then we would research the material. He would have an answer, and that would make the news. I also covered the Navy Department and the State Department, Capitol Hill, and the White House. On those days on the days of the press conferences, I could either wear civilian clothes or military uniform, although later when we got in the war, we all wore uniforms. At any rate, I covered President Roosevelt's press conferences, Tuesdays and Thursdays, Tuesday morning in the morning, Thursdays in the afternoon, so that both the morning papers and the afternoon papers would get a crack at the breaking news. And I think I was the only one of the Washington Press Corps whose news reports were stamped confidential at the War Department. Now, why do you ask, why were they stamped confidential? They were stamped confidential and delivered to all the chiefs of the War Department, General Headquarters staff. They were stamped confidential because I was instructed to include in those reports all of the president's off-the-record comments, which wouldn't get into the news reports. And it shows you how important is the information and political process in Washington, because the people in the government would want to know as early as possible what was being said in the vast bureaucracy, which is Washington, D.C. That was one of the ways to do it. And so all the staff chiefs of the War Department, all the secretary, the undersecretaries, and so forth. And I used to hand carry my report by special vehicle out to Woodley, which was the Secretary of War's home. And I used to hand present it to him. That was one of my special duties. And many people have anecdotes about the Washington. By Washington and President Roosevelt. And one that I remember most, if you're interested, is President Roosevelt's jaunty angle of holding his cigarette holder. Remember that?
Yes.
It was kind of a jaunty right. angle. It was kind of high. Yeah. Up, remember that? Now, everybody felt that was because of his character, his cocky self-confidence, etc. As you know, he was crippled from polio. And they thought that was a matter of overcoming that. Mm-hmm. Well, it was none of those things at all. It happened that President Roosevelt had bad teeth, and that's the way his cigarette holder stuck in his mouth. So everybody thought it was a jaunty angle. It made everybody think he was a macho, etc. But it was only a case of bad teeth. He was very sharp, and he taught me a great many things without realizing it. Naturally, we used to ask him questions. Mr. President, if Germany does this, what will we do? And to try to draw out the president. That was in the Oval Office before the Oval Office became so well known as the Oval Office. Now you say Oval Office, and you don't have to say White House. But in those days, we called it the Oval Office. At any rate, he had all kinds of gadgets on his table, and was clean. And he was a clean desk man in the sense that right in front of him was always clean. That's a term we used in Washington. If anybody was a clean desk man, that means he was pretty efficient. So even though you had to throw junk in a wastebasket underneath your desk, if you were interviewing somebody, you had a clean desk, it'd be clean. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we used to ask him questions about, if Germany would do this, how would we respond, if a troop ship was bombed, lend-lease, whatever. And we would say, Mr. President, if an American ship is torpedoed, so forth, what would be our response? And he used to cock that cigarette holder, and he used to look you in the eye, and he used to say, young man, that's an iffy question. And that's the way he would fend off asking questions. Anyway, that experience in Washington was an enormous help to me, because it was the center of the news world. And I might parenthetically bring in something here, if you don't want to use, you stop me. But when I went overseas to India and China, I was in the Far East, which you probably want to talk about later. I was there about almost 3 years. At any rate, when I came down, I went to work in Washington. This goes back to something, other questions, love and courtship you're asking. When the offer came to me there to come back to Pittsburgh, we decided to come back, and I had been flying so much that for a number of years I only went by land. I had enough of the air. And Evelyn and I were riding back from Washington to Pittsburgh to take a job here at the Post-Gazette as assistant Sunday editor.
About when is this?
That was about 49.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little concerned because, I told you, Washington was the center of the news world and was, all full of everything that I wanted. I'd, by that time, gotten out of the service and so forth. I'd been a civilian again. And she saw that I was concerned. And she says, why are you concerned, honey? It's upward mobility. And I told her, I know this is the center of the news world. And going back to Pittsburgh, which was a little stuffy.
Provincial.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she said to me a famous phrase in our life that became famous. She says, honey, she says, if it's not the right decision, we'll make it the right decision. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very philosophical comment at a time of stress. Are you making the right decision? And it's been something that we've used over and over again when we had to make difficult decisions in our lives. So I give her the credit. Back to Washington.
That's lovely.
She's great.
Would you like to comment on how things were in 1941? Why is it that they called you up? Was there war fever in 41? How was the atmosphere?
I don't think there was war fever. I think it would be more fair to classify it as war anxiety. There was a tension. And I think anxiety is a more precise term.
Mm-hmm.
Concern, worry. I don't have to tell you what war means to anybody. Superimposed upon that was a mad dictator, a murderous dictator, the worst the world has ever known abroad in Germany and Europe. Hitler, the persecution of the Jews was intensifying. The stuff was just
was that started. Well known in 41? How?
I think it was better known than anybody would like to admit.
Really?
That what wasn't known was assumed. Of course, that was 41. But you have to realize the first concentration camps were developed after Hitler came into power in 1933. So it's. But you see the parallel today. Today, nobody wants to meet on the head issue of international terrorism. And if you trace back today, international terrorism, you see where it's aided and abetted. Nobody wants to put it where it's really aided and abetted. How do they get supplies and arms? Where is it? Where are the hotbeds? And how are the hotbeds supplied and supported? Nobody wants to come head on to that issue. We would like to bury our heads in the mm-hmm. sand, or at least, you know, right. put on blinders.
So the parallel in 41...
The parallel is a good one, except you have to have an historical perspective in order to...
Well, let's go back now to 41, and we'll get back to this as we go on. How did you feel about being called to service in 1941?
Oh, I was ready, willing, and able.
And as a Jew, how did you feel about it?
Very strong. I still feel to this day that little credit is given to Jewish martial spirit. You know, for years Jews suffered under the stigma of being timid guys, cringing, after all, the Jewish War Veterans is the oldest Jewish war veteran organization in America. But the image is of the Jew who will not strike back when he's pogromized or beaten, and the Jew has suffered under that kind of a stigma in many different ways, both historically and personally. And therefore, I felt that it's important for every young Jewish boy to have under his belt a significant amount of military and patriotic training.
So you spent
very important to this mm-hmm. very minute. Remember, this was before the rebirth of the State of Israel, when an entirely new image had been given to the vigorous, defense-minded Jew. Now, Jews were a strong and martial people from mm-hmm. from the first day of their birth. The Jews marched out of Egypt in ordered form. There was no rabble. They came out in ordered form, in trained form. As a matter of fact, if you take a look in the Bible and you see how the Jews encamped with the Oren HaKodesh, the Holy of Holies, in the center, and flanked on every side by the different tribes, you will see how the British, thousands of years later, came across the idea of the British Square.
Mm-hmm.
And if you you have to take a look at Saul and David, and you know that they were vigorous and martial people, and under thousands of years of persecution, and disarmed and defenseless, they got that stigma of not being able to stand up for their rights. It's in our era that has changed, obviously, both in. And this has overtones not only in physical terms, but in sociological and political terms as well.
Would you like to comment on why it is that down through history, we Jews are aware of everything you're saying? Why hasn't that reached the Christian population? Why is it so hard to get that message out?
In the first place, I'm not sure we do realize it. I'm not so sure we do respect it. And I'm... And remember, our training is bilateral, or ambivalent, if you wish. After all, we're road of shalom. We're pursuers of peace. Shalom is our greeting. We love peace. So we're not fully oriented. And since we've been persecuted, and beaten, and driven, and rejected, and made pariahs. Sometimes defenselessness wasn't itself a defense, and since those who made us defenseless exercised their sense of superiority by saying, "Look, we can kick them around," and the persecution, the pogroms, when the Jews didn't fight back, or they did fight back, they were slaughtered. The destruction of the temple, you know, the Romans probably slaughtered 500,000 Jews.
So that
feeling of being defenseless and the defenselessness forced upon us because we didn't have any methods to fight back. You find it to this day that the accusations within and without the Jewish community, why did they go to slaughter like sheep in the Holocaust? The most ridiculous...